And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. In her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, Olivia Lang examines the impact alcohol had on the lives and work of six great American writers: Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tennessee Williams, John Cheever, John Berryman, and Raymond Carver. As part of her research, Lang traveled across the United States visiting these writers' haunts and homes, which nurtured their imagination. Although each of these men was unique, Lang did notice startling biographical similarities that may have compelled them to find solace in a bottle. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Lang. He began by asking her if she discovered any connection between alcoholism and creativity.
That is a large question. There are all kinds of connections between alcohol and creativity. The thing I didn't find is that writers were writing drunk. That's the sort of myth about it. And actually, that was a lot less prevalent than I was expecting. You see it a little bit in Fitzgerald. Summer of Tender is the Night he wrote drunk and kind of regretted it afterwards. And a lot of his late stories were written drunk. Apart from that, people tended to be writing around the edges of creative life. So you'd get somebody like Hemingway who would be working in the day and then drinking as a sort of way of changing the tune, changing the channel at the end of the working day. But the bigger relationship, I think, comes when we look at origins, the reasons that people come to produce creative work, the reasons that people come to drink seem to arise from sort of similar places. Not exactly the same place, it's important to say that. But there were similar senses around it, that there were things to do with difficult childhoods, that there were things to do with unease, anxiety, that seemed to drive these men towards both the desire to produce fiction, to produce written work, and the desire to obliterate, annihilate themselves with alcohol.
Well, they all had complicated relationships with their parents.
They absolutely did, yeah, and really quite similar complicated relationships with their parents. And this isn't something I sort of set out to do. I didn't know that in advance, but that's the way it turned out. They all experienced their parents as being weak fathers and overbearing mothers. You see that over and over again. So Hemingway found his mother incredibly overbearing. These fathers who could be depressed, suicidal, many of their fathers either threatened to or did kill themselves. So John Cheever's father, who drank a lot, periodically threatened to commit suicide. John Berryman's father shot himself when Berryman was really a very small boy, in fact, outside his bedroom window in Florida. And Hemingway's father, of course, killed himself when Hemingway was an adult, but nonetheless, he felt it an extremely damaging blow.
Well, you look at six American writers in your book. Mm. They're all male. Why no female writers? I mean, they drink too, don't they?
Of course they drink too, yeah, absolutely. And there's a book that I could easily have written about six female writers, and it would have included people like Jean Rhys, like Marguerite Duras, like Elizabeth Bishop. And I think the interesting thing about that would have been the ways in which male drinking is socially sanctioned and often quite glamorous. Female drinking absolutely isn't. It's seen as much more deviant, it's much more judged. So it would be a fascinating book. The reason I didn't do that is because my experience as a child was with a female alcoholic, and I found it too painful. I had very frightening experiences as a little girl, and it wasn't something that I felt I was able to deal with. I think I would have brought too much of my own baggage in, and I don't think that's appropriate.
We're speaking with Olivia Lang about her new book, The Trip to Echo Spring. Where's that title come from?
The title comes from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams' wonderful play, and the alcoholic Brick, who is a retired football hero, he's injured his leg and he keeps hobbling to the liquor cabinet in the house. And his wife, Maggie the Cat, who is played famously by Elizabeth Taylor, keeps saying, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm making a little short trip to Echo Spring." And Echo Spring is a brand of Kentucky bourbon. You can buy it now. And it's also something else. I think there's a reason why Williams chose that particular bourbon. It's seems to suggest some symbolic place that the drinker might want to go to. And it was that place, it was that motivation that I really wanted to unpick and understand.
Well, let's look at Williams for a moment. He had, again, a very complicated upbringing. Was he always a drinker?
His drinking starts, we know actually Williams' first drink, he was 17, and he was on a cruise to France. He was going to go on a kind of grand tour of Europe with his grandfather, who he absolutely adored. And at that point, William's, it's not a happy home life. His father is aggressive, quite violent. His mother is neurotic, as anyone who's seen The Glass Menagerie will know. That's very close to his mother, Amanda Wingfield. His sister is in the process of going mad. So at this point, he's suffering from anxiety attacks. He's a very, very highly strung young man. And his first drink is creme de menthe on the trip just out of New York, and he doesn't like it. In fact, he's sick almost immediately afterwards. Very soon after that, he realises this is a substance that has the power to quell my anxiety, and he is desperate for something to quell his anxiety. In later life, he will also discover tranquilizers and have a long and awful love affair with them. But the drinking really stems from the fact that he can self-medicate with it. That's what is the source, I think, of, as he was then, Tom Williams drinking.
Well, the tragedy about Tennessee Williams is that the last 20, 22 years of his life was really a waste, a mess. He didn't produce any really good work. Was that because he just could no longer cope with his addictions?
Yeah, the late Tennessee Williams is a very sad story, because he keeps producing plays, he keeps writing plays, and they're very clearly damaged by alcohol. They're structurally quite incoherent, they're very experimental, and he couldn't get them staged often. If he did get them staged, then the run would end very quickly, the takings would be down. It was all extremely humiliating, and the critics turned on him pretty much after Night of the Iguana. That was his last really big success. Having said that, and I think that's very much to do with his drinking, having said that, there is a case for his work being more experimental than his time will allow. And I know they're starting, these short plays that he wrote are starting to be staged again now. For example, The Mutilated has just been on in New York with Penny Arcade and Mink Stole, who are two sort of classic New York actresses. And I think sometimes if the actress appears, then the play can be held around that, because Williams always wrote these wonderful roles for women. So it's possible that there'll be a kind of revisiting of his late reputation. I wonder if that will happen.
We're speaking with Olivia Lang, whose new book is The Trip to Echo Spring. The relationship that, because he was gay, and in fact, sexuality does play a role, I think, in some of these writers.
A huge role.
Yeah, because I noticed that they had what we would call a confused sexuality.
Yeah.
And he was unusual in the sense that in his time, he was very open about his homosexuality. And most writers who were gay were closeted. Did that add to the anxiety? Did that add to the drinking?
I don't think it did, and it's one of the things I really love about Tennessee Williams, is that he very quickly realised what his sexual desires were, and he seems to have been absolutely comfortable about that. He seems to have been really clear about what he wanted. He had a long-term relationship with Frank Merlot, and that was very public. Frank and he travelled together. Everyone knew that they were a couple. Unlike some people, like, for example, Benjamin Britten, who keeps it much more sort of people know, but it's on the QT, I think he was proud of his sexuality. He was very advanced in his sense of it. And one can contrast that with John Cheever, who also felt erotic desire for men and considered that a source of absolute shame.
Well, Cheever, let's move on to Cheever for a moment, because I'm a big fan of Cheever, and I don't think he gets to do that he deserves, because he is, I think, one of America's greatest short story writers.
Yeah.
His life was really schizophrenic, in the sense that he was married, had children, lived in the suburbs, and yet he was not the normal family man, was he?
I don't like that word normal, but he wasn't a family man.
Okay.
He wasn't a heterosexual family man.
Around it, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But nothing about Cheever is as it seems, in the same way that nothing in his stories is as it seems. He came from really a very poor, ordinary background, really sometimes quite almost squalid, and he did not want that to be who he was. So he reinvented himself very deliberately. He married up. He created this sort of waspy persona. He dressed in Brooks Brothers. He cultivated a particular voice that made it sound like he was much more well-bred. all of that was this sort of desire to stage manage an existence, stage manage a character who was impeccable, and that did not fit at all with what John himself actually desired, which was to be loved by a man. And this is the great tragedy of his diaries, which are incredibly vast, is that he couldn't... He said at one point, any bank delivery worker, any delivery guy is aimed at my life like a loaded gun. And that's how perilous he felt his sexuality was.
Hmm. Well, there's quite a lot of drinking in his stories.
Mm.
You see it again and again. These men who live in suburban existences and they just drink all the time. So clearly that was autobiographical. There was a connection there.
Yeah.
The thing is, How did he overcome it? Because at some point he did overcome the drinking, didn't he?
Yeah, and he's a classic example of one of those people who hit rock bottom. He, first of all, experienced strong physical consequences. He had a heart attack. He was hospitalised. After that, he kept on going. He went off to Iowa on his own, and he taught there for a year and set about pretty seriously trying to drink himself to death. And his brother rescued him. His brother took him away, and he went to a treatment center, and there he managed to just force himself to get dry.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with author Olivia Lang. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is author Olivia Lang, whose new book, The Trip to Echo Spring, examines the role alcohol played in the lives and work of six American writers. Two of those writers are F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway.
Mm.
Now, they're the most famous of the writers that you cover.
Absolutely.
What did you learn about them?
What was interesting with them to me, I mean, obviously they're very well documented, but I was looking particularly at the way that alcohol had affected their lives and affected their friendship. And this is a friendship that starts out in Paris, and it's two men who really fell for each other. I'm not saying in a particularly romantic way, but as friends, they really adored each other. They really got a kick out of each other. They liked each other's work, but they liked each other's company. And over the years, over the decades, that relationship sours because of alcohol. And so I kind of tracked the way that happened. And what happens is Fitzgerald's drinking takes him to a bad place much quicker than Hemingway. Hemingway has an extraordinary constitution, Fitzgerald not so much. So Fitzgerald starts becoming the irritating drunk friend. And Hemingway's very, very judgmental about that. And what I found really interesting is that when he came to write A Movable Feast, long after Fitzgerald had died, Hemingway used that as an opportunity to keep saying, Scott was a bad drinker. I was a good drinker. Scott was a bad drinker. Classic Hemingway. And I looked at the circumstances in Hemingway's life as he was writing that book, which was published posthumously, but he was working on towards the end of his life. And it turned out, which I was really surprised by, that this was the one moment in Hemingway's life where he really confronted the fact that his drinking was out of control, that his drinking was potentially going to kill him. He was on a diet from his doctors because of the liver damage that alcohol was causing, in which he couldn't drink at all. And he was writing letters saying, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I'm feeling I can't cope. I desperately need to drink and I can't. And at the same time, he was writing this supposed memoir, but actually I think it's a piece of fiction, that talks over and over again about Scott the drunkard and Hemingway, who just in a European way loves alcohol, but not in a bad way.
Well, in the 1920s when they first met, Fitzgerald was ahead of Hemingway sense of he was much more famous, best-selling author, and Hemingway was just beginning.
Gatsby just about to come out.
Yep. Right. And then in the 1930s, everything turns around.
Yes,
Hemingway
completely.
Is the star, and Fitzgerald is falling.
In decline.
And then there are these two works. Fitzgerald writes this essay called The Crack-Up, which talks very openly, very candidly about his... Mm. alcoholism, his...
Well, no, no. It talks very candidly about his depression. It talks about his nervous breakdown. It doesn't ever admit that it's caused by alcohol. It's another of these texts that is actually quite slippery.
But isn't it implied?
No, no.
Really?
No.
Oh,
it
okay.
It touches very lightly on it, but no, it never says.
Okay.
It's a confession. It's an early piece of confessional literature that doesn't actually confess what's really happening.
But... how does Hemingway respond to that when he hears about it? How does he respond?
Hemingway behaves appallingly at that point. He is absolutely furious. He thinks Scott has given up, given in. It's shameful what he's done. And I think there's clearly ways in which he's thinking about his own father who shot himself. And that same idea of cowardice comes into play. That same idea of things being shameful comes into play. He writes all kinds of angry letters to mutual friends, their mutual editor. And then the worst thing he does is he writes his own short story and he puts in a character who he calls Fitzgerald, Scott Fitzgerald, in the first edition. Later he changes it to another name, but it's very clear who he's talking about. And he talks about this person writing this essay, which is based on the crack-up, which is just so cruel. And Fitzgerald is devastated and writes a letter saying... could you please lay off me in print in this kind of resigned way? Like, I know I'm going to get a lot of hits from you, but this is a hit too much.
And what I find funny about it is that after Fitzgerald dies in 1940, after spending a couple of very sad years in Hollywood, his star starts to rise again.
Mm.
So that by the time Hemingway shoots himself, Fitzgerald is now considered a major part of the American canon. So they have, again, this competition that even goes beyond life. It just never ends.
Yeah, very rivalrous. And you can see that sort of jealousy when Hemingway's often asked by Fitzgerald's biographers if he'll talk about him, and he can never resist the opportunity to... land a few digs, and there's that sort of that sense of cruelty, jealousy, something going on there. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember how much he did love him as well, how much he used to enjoy his company. When you look at the letters written at the time, it's a very different picture that emerges.
We're speaking with Olivia Lang about her new book, The Trip to Echo Spring. You did a lot of research for this. You traveled quite a bit throughout the United States. You visited many of the places where these writers lived. You also looked at support groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and the Alcohol Institute or
the Addiction Institute.
The Addiction Institute in Manhattan. And there's been some some the skepticism about AA, about Alcoholics Anonymous, because people sometimes say that, well, they really emphasize the spiritual, the God, with the 12 steps, you know, the higher power.
Yeah.
And for someone who isn't necessarily a believer, that could be a problem.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
Well, I came in pretty cynical about AA. I wasn't expecting to have feelings one way or the other about it. I guess I had a kind of a skeptical eyebrow about it. What changed my feeling about it? It's partly that it was successful for the two writers who did get sober, Cheever and Carver, but particularly it was the experience of going to an AA meeting and realizing how much it's about fellowship. So forget the good stuff. It's about people who've been through the experience wishing to then help other people who are caught in alcoholism. And what really hit home for me was I was at a meeting and people were doing their birthdays, which is how long they've been sober. And some people were like, I've been sober 20 days. And some people were like, I've been sober 20 weeks. And then somebody stood up and said, it's my 20-year birthday. And the thought that somebody after 20 years of sobriety said, my kid has never seen me drunk. You know, that's how long it is. And yet he was still turning up at meetings because his presence in the room meant something to the guy who was on 20 days. Well, I don't think we need a higher power. I think it's about humans helping humans out.
I remember once I was in my office and someone came by. This was someone I had known 10 years ago. And she, I was surprised to see her. And suddenly she started talking. She said, well, look, I just want to tell you I'm sorry about anything that might have happened. And it dawned on me that this is the ninth step.
Hmm.
She must be doing the ninth step.
Yeah.
I mean, she never told me what was going on, but...
But you realized.
But I realized, yeah. And it really hit me that... which I felt sorry for because... Not in a condescending way, just...
Yeah.
You know, what had happened in the years intervening to lead her to this point.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's humbling. And I think the more I read about alcoholism, the more, you know, it's there but for the grace of God that any of us aren't in that situation.
Or any addiction.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because it could be sexual addiction, it could be... food, it could be any addiction. We're surrounded by temptations. The last two writers, Raymond Carver and Jared Berryman, they're perhaps not that well known to the American public.
No, I think Raymond Carver probably more so, because I think what we talk about love was a huge hit when it came out.
They made a movie out of it. Or Robert Altman.
Yeah, Shortcuts. Yeah, that's right. I haven't seen that for a long time. I think because he died young, perhaps his star has slightly waned. But John Berryman is certainly the least well-known, despite the fact that he won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. His best work, to my mind, is The Dream Songs. And he had really the worst time of any of them, I think, with drinking. He ended up killing himself, but that was after 3 passes through recovery, 3 attempts to get sober. And he wrote an extraordinary unfinished novel, which is basically autobiographical, very lightly dressed in fiction. And that was about his own recovery experience. And he couldn't finish it. He ended up jumping off a bridge in Minnesota.
But Carver, he beat it, didn't he?
Carver beat it. Carver absolutely beat it. And Carver won himself this second life of sobriety. He was living out in Port Angeles in Washington State and writing what I think are some of his best stories. So that idea that the alcohol is the creative force and that once the alcohol goes, you lose your creativity, I think that... can be a fear for people, but he really does prove that you can write your best work sober, and I think he felt that the work he was producing was his best, and I think he's right.
But he came from such a impoverished background. So it wasn't just simply the question of creativity, it was just that he had a lot of burdens that he had to deal with.
He had a lot of burdens. I mean, he married very young, he had his first child very young, and then his wife got pregnant almost immediately after that baby was born, and they were in debt to the hospital from the get-go. So there was always this sense of being behind. Carver knew he wanted to be a writer, but he could barely afford to go to university. It took him a long time to get going, and I think drink plays a part in knocking back some of the bitterness of that, drowning out some of the bitterness. But also it's important to remember his father was drinking very hard, and these things are at least 50% genetic, as well as everything else, as well as all the other elements. We know now that it is 50% genetic.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Olivia Lang.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and, of course, interviews authors for Topical Currents. Food and Dining, up next. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, joining you in our hopes for Joseph Cooper's speedy return from a back injury. Well, last week at this time, we looked at the craft beer movement in Florida, but there's an ongoing craft food revolution happening in the Wynwood neighborhood of Miami-Dade County. Joining us now is Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend, Linda Gassenheimer. Good afternoon, Linda. Welcome.
I'm glad you put the friend in there, Bonnie.
I know. You look for that.
Yes. Nice to see you.
Likewise.
And Bonnie, you didn't mention that our studio's filled with special glow and aroma. Freshly baked artisan bread. What a treat.
Yes.
Yes. And they're brought here by our guest, Zach Stern. He's better known as Zach the Baker. And he's going to talk to us about artisan bread baking, but also about something you may have heard of, and that's crowdfunders. Sounds strange? Well, it's a concept that's taking root, and we're going to hear all about it from Zach. So let's welcome Zach Stern. Zach the Baker, welcome.
Hi. Thanks welcome, for having welcome. Me. Hi, Bonnie. Hi, Linda.
Great to have you here, especially with all this food here.
Oh, you'd be welcome anyway, yeah, Zach.
Yes, exactly. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions about crowdfunding or maybe about making the perfect bread? Sounds like an unusual combination, but they are connected. Give us a call, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email is radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes columns. And you can also read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, you folks are talking about craft food, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about craft beer.
Sounds good to me. Zach the Baker, you've made a leap from renting a small space to bake your extraordinary breads in a new facility that just opened up in Wynwood. It's a bakery and a cafe. So tell us, how were you able to expand from your small kitchen into your grand new big facility?
It was a slow process, but it was also fast at the same time. We tried not to rush anything, and we tried to make sure that the business justified the reason to grow into the next place. So we started off in the garage, and once we expanded to a point where they kicked us out of the garage because there was dough everywhere, and we were making a mess, then we looked for a new facility, and we found something in Hialeah, which was a more commercial, more professional place, which is what we needed anyway. So we went into this commercial kitchen, and we slowly expanded.
This was just making bread.
Just making bread.
Okay.
Just bread, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The staff of life.
Of his life, for sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, Hialeah, we baked and baked and baked. It was a struggle, you know, the whole way through. There wasn't a lot of money to pay a lot of employees, and so there was a lot of working, a lot of late nights and early mornings. But then once we had a big enough wholesale business, we were able to justify looking into another option. And we really wanted to take the wholesale business and make it present so people can see what we're doing, because we're doing something really cool. It's very real. It's very authentic.
When you say you're doing something real cool, can people now go into your facility and see you making the bread?
Sure. Yeah. So that was the point. Every day we go and we take this flour and water and we mix it and we create something. And it's a neat process. It's fun to watch. Kids, adults, they can be mesmerized by it. So at the bakery, you can come, you can sit and have lunch at the cafe and literally watch us during lunchtime, watch us shaping the bread. And it's neat. You don't get to see production like that anymore by real people.
Do you give classes?
Actually, we just did one last night, but we're not really set up for it yet. I'm kind of tired. I got to get a little bit more sleep, and then we can entertain these fun things.
So tell me then, it's very interesting how you raised money. I mean, the bread ovens are very, very expensive. You have to sell a lot of bread to cover those costs. How did you raise the funding for this?
The majority of the funding was raised through a loan. I took a big loan and I put it on my shoulders, and I feel it every day. And then when we got to the construction and it started going, and we started running through the money in a second. The grease trap, the plumbing, the electric, the air, the gas, the permits for every little city thing, they all take their piece of the pie. But then we ran out of money, and we didn't have tables, we didn't have chairs, we didn't have anything. So then instead of going to a private investor or going back to the bank, I wanted to keep the business owned 100% by the bakers. It was important to me. So I reached out to this alternative way of raising money, and this is where Kickstarter came into the play.
So Kickstarter, it's called crowdfunding. So there are other avenues people can go besides Kickstarter. But so explain what it is.
Sure. So Kickstarter seems to be the most popular one as far as I can see. Kickstarter is a way for anybody with a project. It has to be specific. There's guidelines and rules. They want to raise money, and people. They have a goal. They create a goal. So our goal was $30,000. That's what we needed. So we have this $30,000 goal, and we create a timeline. 30 days. That was our timeline. And then we offer, sort of like you guys do, the pledge drive. We offer different pledges, the 5, the 10, the 20, the 50, the 500, the 1,000.
And what do you offer for it when you offer that?
We offer, similar to you guys, a tote bag.
Oh, okay.
That was okay. So there, for if you give $5, $10, you get a loaf of bread. You give $25, you get lunch when we open up. If you give $300, you get a loaf of bread every week for a year. $400, lunch every week for a year. You're basically you're pre-buying, you know, the
right.
So what? It's actually a form of barter.
Sure.
What used to be the way people had their ran their businesses before.
Yeah, they're pre-ordering their food, their bread from us, and it gives us a chance to get going, and then they come and they collect their reward.
So then you made your
$30,000
in 30 days.
Yeah, we did.
Well, that is amazing.
And what was the 30 days about? Why did you limit it to 30 days?
Well, there's analytics that suggest what's the most popular for this, what's the best way to get it. But 30 days, here's the caveat. If you don't reach that $30,000 goal that you picked, you get nothing.
Oh.
So it's stressful.
No wonder you haven't slept in 3 months.
That's not the only reason. That's part of it.
But Kickstarter is a company. So do they take some of the money, some of the funding that you get?
Sure, but it's not egregious. It's something like 5%. So if you can do the math.
So you need to do... Do your math beforehand.
So they get $1,500 and you get $28,500.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. Okay, so now I mentioned that we had this studio filled with all this beautiful, beautiful bread. Tell us what we've got here. And I've got a plate here full of food. And Bonnie's looking at me like she's going to take it from me.
I'm coveting your bread.
Right. So tell us about the bread you bought.
Sure. So we make country bread. It's an old, ancient bread. We don't use yeast. It's flour, it's water, it's salt, and it's got the mother, the sourdough. And it's just an ancient form of bread.
And so for people who don't understand what a mother is, that's the...
The mother is the mother dough. Every time we make dough, we save a piece, and we put it in the next dough, and that's what's responsible for rising the bread. We don't use yeast. We don't use a commercial yeast in that sense. We use an old piece of dough, and it naturally rises the bread. They call it natural leaven. And this is what gives it the characteristic of this... this creamy, chewy, slightly acidic, this beautiful crust. The color on it is amber. It's not gold. It's even darker. It's rustic.
But it doesn't taste completely like sourdough bread.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's all technique. You know, you can manipulate the process and you can control the acidity high or low.
I see.
Right. I was going to explain what the loaves look like, but he's done such a great job. There are four loaves here, and they do have like a dark crust. The dough inside is very light. A lot of holes in the dough. What? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's the pride and joy, right. The crumb. The inside is the crumb. The outside is the crust. So our goal is to get a crusty crust and a very holy crumb, because the more holes, the creamier, the softer it is, the tighter the crumb, the drier, the denser it is. So you go and you look at bread around, you take a look at the crumb, and you notice the pattern on it. If there's nice big holes, well, that's going to be a very creamy, tasty bread.
It's also lighter.
Yeah, very light.
Because of that, yeah.
And we've got four different ones here. So what have we got?
So I brought four sourdough breads. It's the Jewish rye. We've got sourdough country bread. We've got sourdough multigrain. And then we've also got a sourdough walnut and cranberry.
And we've eaten them all, haven't we, Bonnie?
Yes, we have.
But then we have a plate here full of, you call them schmears. So tell us, what is a schmear?
Oh, it's not a schmear. That sounds like Einstein's bagels. It's stuff you put on bread, you know, a bunch of stuff on bread.
Okay, so we have one here that has, it's herring.
Sure. So at our cafe, one of our main things that we highlight, the way to showcase the bread, is we have these toasts. And we have a variety of sweet toasts and a variety of savory toasts. And so today I brought you a nice mix. The chef prepared, she's got a roasted beet with feta and za'atar. She's got a whipped ricotta with roasted garlic. And that looks like a local summer squash. There's a schmaltz herring. This is the one I'm really proud of. It's schmaltz herring, creme fraiche, and a little bit of dill on the top. And that comes with... if I'm around, I'll give you a little bit of vodka to make it go
and
down.
And I have to say, Trevor, he did give us a little bit of vodka.
Some of us.
Some of us.
Now, let me ask you, I always thought schmaltz was chicken fat.
Well, schmaltz, I believe in, I may be wrong, but schmaltz is Yiddish for fat. And so schmaltz herring, I believe, refers to a herring at its fattiest time of life.
I see.
It's right before it's about to spawn. It's got all that fat, and it's so good.
All right. So a couple of questions. What happens when you go from a very small garage, then a little kitchen, and now a big facility? How do you keep up this artisan? How do you keep up the quality?
It's a really good question, and it's something that I think that I've struggled with the whole time. You can't, with something that is handmade like this, an old-fashioned bread, you can't just turn up the knob on production. You know, you can't just go from 100 to 200 to 300 in one day. It's difficult. It's all about your equipment, number one. Can your equipment handle your demand? And number two, what's your system like? Are you tight in your systems? Are your observations clean? Are you taking down good notes? Are you keeping a very tight time temperature profile and everything?
So it's hard work because you're up at 3 a.m. and you're there till midnight or something, I would think.
I don't sleep very much. No, my brain is mush. They say that being sleep deprived is like being drunk, and it's how I feel.
Is it like the crumb?
The crumb?
Lots of holes.
Well, let this go for one. There's a craft revolution going on in Wynwood. So tell us, what's going on there?
Yeah, Wynwood. There's something cool happening in Wynwood. And I'm from Miami, so I've seen things pop up here and there. You know, Coconut Grove, Lincoln Road, this and that. But Wynwood, there's something unique happening in the sense that there's something independent, something with a soul, with a heartbeat. And I can feel it, and it's at the beginning, and it's really starting to pound. And as far as food, craft food in the revolution, there's a few craftsmen there that are focusing on food. For instance, you got Panther Coffee, which are making great roasted coffee there, and they've got a coffee house you can sit at, and it's a great place to go to. There's Wynwood Brewery. They're making their own beer there. There's us making bread there. There's a Hugo Fresh, which is making cold pressed juice. So there's all these people doing things, you know, and they're not franchise brands. No offense to them, but it's something different. And in Miami, that's hard to find that. Mm-hmm. And it's all on this 5x10 block.
Well, we're going to ask you more about that in a minute, but we're going to go to a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Zach the Baker. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Zach Stern, better known as Zach the Baker. He's moved his bakery to larger quarters in Wynwood, and he's been giving us tips on making the perfect artisan bread and explaining Kickstarter, which has been a great success for him. Let's go to Cindy. She's been holding on. Hi, Cindy in Miami. Thanks for holding.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Thank you. First off, I was listening to the interview, and it's no coincidence that you moved into an area of doers, because that's what you are. I've been buying the bread from the bookstore in Coconut Grove, at the Daily Bread, and at the Pinecrest Market, and have followed your progress and contributed a little bit to the Kickstarter, and was so happy to see that work out for you, because it meant that there were enough people locally that got what you were doing. You epitomize homegrown talent. You give so much to our community. You serve Panther Coffee. You hire local carpenters, potters. You sell local vegetables, and you're an inspiration.
And okay, Cindy, thank you so much.
Cindy,
for
thank you. You're
welcome.
It's very nice to hear that. Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to go to dinner in minutes.
Great.
And today's dinner, it's a Korean grilled chicken with steamed noodles. And it's easy to savor the flavors of Korea because this chicken, it's coated with a garlicky soy sauce glaze. Now, you can grill the chicken outside, or you could cook it on a stovetop grill, or you could even sauté it. Anyway, any way you like. And I use chicken thighs because they have a lot more flavor. I put them in a bowl or maybe a plastic bag if you'd like, so with some soy sauce, some vinegar, garlic, sesame oil, mustard, and ginger, and I let it marinate. And while it's marinating, I make some noodles, which is very simple to make. And then what I do is I keep the marinade. I pour it into a saucepan, and I cook it to a glaze while the chicken cooks. And then you put that glaze over the chicken so you get a nice, nice garlicky feel to it. And for the noodles, you just boil some Chinese noodles. I put in the same pan broccoli florets, some shredded carrots. There's no cutting or chopping here. You buy it already, ready to go. And you toss that with some sesame oil. And I like to buy toasted sesame oil in this market. It has a nice flavor. It's a very simple dish. It's easy. The complete dish, the recipe, and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's @LGassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, you folks are talking about Wynnewood with all its new foodie reputation, and Wynnewood also has a new brewery, as Zach mentioned, and so I guess it's going to get a drinky reputation as well.
A drinky reputation?
Yeah, that's a good straight thing. And it's actually leading the way as Miami finally and belatedly joins the national trend toward craft beers. Wynnewood Brewery makes a variety of brews, a blonde ale, an IPA or India Pale Ale, a porter, a Belgian gold strong beer, and several others. And with them in the lead, other craft breweries are springing up all around South Florida. And in fact, this is going on all over the country. Craft beers are up 15% in the past year, while regular beer is, you should pardon the expression, flat.
Fred, are you drinking beer while you're talking here?
It had to be said. Now, the thing about craft beers is they're a lot more fun than regular commercial beers, and here's why. If you're in a craft brewery, the brewer has no corporate bosses to tell him or her what to do and no marketing studies to worry about. So the brewer is turned loose to act out his or her fantasies. And this has led to what...
Remember,
in a lot
this
of
is NPR, okay, about this, you know, fantasies and all.
Well, these are beer fantasies.
Okay,
not,
good.
Not the other kind of fantasies. Although, well, never mind. and this around the country has led to what is called extreme beer. You have India pale ales with twice the alcohol of regular Budweiser. You have blonde lagers with three times the hops of regular beer, making them three times as bitter. And these are powerful, powerful beers. But you also have novelty beers that are just plain fun. Wynnewood makes a beer flavored with white chocolate and coconut, which sounds actually pretty good.
Is that in the beer, or is it just flavored?
They actually add it. Other breweries buy Godiva chocolate and put it right into the beer. I guess it dissolves in some way. And another brewery that I know about, not the Wynnewood one, makes what they call an Elvis Presley beer that's based on the singer's favorite sandwich. It has flavors of peanut butter and bananas, and for an extra 75 cents, they'll lay a strip of bacon across the top of the glass.
Is the beer?
This is the beer.
So we're going to have peanut butter and banana in my beer with bacon?
No, it sounds good.
Bacon on the top of the glass.
That's right. Yeah, the bacon is on top. They don't put the bacon in the beer,
right. Okay.
Although they probably would if you ask them. Anyway, these are not my favorites, although I am.
Oh, that's a surprise, Fred.
I am kind of coming to like the hoppier beers. But there's one big drawback to craft beers, and that's calories. It seems that with flavor comes weight gain. For example, a Bud Light, just a regular Bud Light made in part with rice as well as barley in order to make it lighter, has only 110 calories. But a powerful India Pale Ale by any number of craft breweries might have 250 calories or more.
For the same amount of beer?
For the same amount of beer, yeah. You'd have to chop wood for 35 minutes, I could do, to burn off the fat.
I was going
to
say.
So some of this is simple, inspired, hands-on brewing, making great beers, and some is just novelty. And whether you like them is up to you. You know what they always say, beauty is in the tongue of the beholder.
I never heard that one, Fred.
You didn't? Well, hang around here. You'll hear a lot.
I don't know. That Michigan air might be getting to you, Fred.
That's right.
Or is it the beer?
It's.
They do a lot of craft beer up here.
Do they? Well, I suppose they would. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you a question. Hoppier? What is hoppier in beer?
More hops.
Well,
more
if you put in physically put in more of the hops plants that are used for making the beer bitter, you make the beer more bitter. And some of them can be three or four times, or even five or six times as many hops as you get in a Bud Light. And it can really pucker you up, but it kind of grows on you. And I kind of like it that way now.
When we did that craft beer show, Fred, I did a little research, and there's a sour beer movement. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. That's beer made with wild yeast. And that, if I've ever come across an acquired taste, that's it. And I have not acquired it.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Literally sour. Why would you want to drink that?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know why you want to drink a beer that's triple bitter either.
Well, when you grow old, you grow bitter, you know.
I wouldn't know. No. Not you. No. Know. No, we wouldn't know, would we, Bonnie?
No. We have an email.
Yes, go ahead.
Here for Zach. Pardon the pronunciation. It's David. He says, I think he might mean Matjes herring, not Schmaltz herring. Not sure, but it does say Matjes on some jars and never saw Schmaltz.
That's Dutch. M-A-J-T-E-S. Is that what it is?
M-A-T-J-E-S.
Right. I think that's the Dutch word for herring, isn't it? Or similar. It's when you buy herring in...
I don't speak Dutch. I don't know.
A certain type of... If it's not the
but thank you for the correction. I appreciate it. as far as I know, you know, it says on the package schmaltz herring, what I've always known it as is schmaltz herring. But yeah, maybe different cultures have different words to describe it. So thank you.
And actually, I might even be correcting myself in the sense that that could be a type of herring.
Right.
When you're in Holland, that's what you get.
Okay.
So, and probably many other countries. But I want to go back to this bread making now. You opened up a cafe. So what do you serve at the cafe? Is it open for breakfast, lunch, dinner? When is it open?
Sure, it's open for breakfast and lunch from 9 to 4, and we have a pretty approachable menu where people can come in and they get to taste the bread and taste what we do. And we have a great chef, Chef Sasha Ariel, and she's made everything from scratch, everything from almond butters to jams, all from scratch. And we have a cured fishes, and we have different spreads, and you have the main thing that we showcase there on the menu are these toasts, which are like open-faced sandwiches, because we were going to make all these sandwiches and we still will, but then once we made one side, we didn't want to smush it with another piece of bread. It was so beautiful, so we said no, we should just keep it open so they can see we're getting local veggies, and it's vibrant and it's bright and the colors are beautiful. So
well,
we
I'm
just
looking
kept
at
them open.
Here and the colors
yes.
are beautiful. So what happens, you can you get the toast and then I can tell you what I want on it? Or is it already
you
made
can,
up?
You can tell us, but we have a menu. No, you come in. Oh. It's quite normal.
like a normal cafe?
Yeah. And no, it sounds like this crazy thing we're doing. But no, it's quite normal. And most people, when they come in, they'll know what to do. They come in, they see a menu, and they read it. They pick what they want. They order. We give it to them. We're very professional.
It's the way it works.
Yeah, yeah. We take credit cards now.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. The whole thing.
Well, great. Well, this has been very, very interesting and very delicious.
Yes, thank you, Zach.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Zach the Baker, thank you for joining us and for the extraordinary baked goods. You can go to, how do we find you, Zach?
You can come to the shop, and I'm there most of the time.
But online?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We have a website. It's www.zackthebaker.com. We also have social media. Right? We've got
Facebook.
Instagram, we got Facebook, we're very hip.
It's Z-A-K.
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 Z-A-K. The Baker.
And his store is at 405 Northwest 26th Street in Wynwood. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie, great to be with you.
Likewise, and thank you, Fred, and thank you, Zach, and thank you, Linda.
And cheers. Next week, we'll be talking with Anna French. She's going to be giving us tips on Brazilian recipes in advance of the
World Cup
tournament. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thank you all for joining us today and spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and assistance from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Please join Ed Bell tomorrow at this time for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. And we'll return on Monday with a look at the future of the public transportation system in Miami-Dade County. Bonnie Berman hoping your day and weekend are great ones. Please stay tuned for Here and Now. Up next from NPR News, thanks for joining us. Next week on